James I's tumultuous first year as king. Plague, conspiracy, and Catholicism. This is a story of a crucial year in the history of England, brimming with great political and social upheaval. 1603 is a new fascinating book by Ben Norman. Delighted to say that Ben joins us live on the line now. Morning to you, Ben.
Morning. Thanks for having me on.
Pleasure's all mine. James I of England, and if you're from north of the border, James VI of Scotland, came in to inherited the crown at a particularly interesting period of English history and Scottish history as well. Describe, if you would, sort of how he ended up running both nations.
Well, basically, Queen Elizabeth I, who reigned for quite a long time, didn't have any children. So there was a political headache about what was going to happen after she died. And there were several candidates that the Privy Council thought might fit the job, but ultimately, she decided on James VI of Scotland. They have shared ancestry going back to Henry VII. So that's what they went with in the end.
And what was the reaction of the populace in general? I mean, presumably they didn't have a referendum on it, but what did they think about somebody who was, you know, who was also King of Scotland taking over the crown that had been the property of Good Queen Bess, as she was known?
Yeah, so that's an interesting question, and it's one I look at in the book a little bit. A lot of people were a bit suspicious about a Scottish man coming south of the border and ruling over them. Obviously, Scotland was very much seen as a foreign country in this period. There are records of people kind of standing in marketplaces and bad-mouthing the king, basically saying, he's not my king, long live the queen. So I think generally speaking, people were quite subservient in this period, so they kind of just accepted it. But there were a few kind of outspoken people, and these were lowly people as well, saddlers, butchers, bakers from all over England.
So what was the personality of James that we'll refer to him as James I in for the rest of the interview, because it gets very confusing otherwise, but yeah. James I, almost people will know about him, or maybe two things, you know, King James Bible, and of course, gunpowder plot, and very sketchy indeed, because the whole horrific story of the failed gunpowder plot, etc., that comes out, you know, later, and it's all about suppression of religion as well, isn't it? And that is a huge issue across Europe at this point.
Yeah, obviously, England has become a Protestant country. It became Protestant in the 16th century under Henry VIII. And by the reign of James I, Catholics are pretty much ostracized from society. And James himself is a Protestant, but his wife is a Catholic, Queen Anna of Denmark, a very kind of notorious Catholic, actually. So this kind of drives suspicion of Catholic uprisings, and indeed in James's reign, in the first year, which is what this book is all about, there are a few Catholic plots to kind of overthrow James and bring back Catholicism. It's difficult to overstate just how unpopular Catholics were in the country in 1603.
Even though there were some... there were some aristocratic and noble families who were still practicing Catholicism at this point.
Yeah,
it hadn't been purged, had it? Like, you know.
No, it hadn't been purged. But it was certainly, there were some very high profile advocates of Catholicism still, but the kind of the national faith, the accepted faith, was Protestantism. And you will actually find a lot of aristocrats who would publicly be for Protestantism, but actually privately they would have, Catholic chaplains, etc. And that's why you have these priest holes in many aristocratic houses, where they would hide their Catholic priests.
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, one of the things that people look at and go, oh, that's quite quaint, and without realizing exactly what it's there for, and the repercussions, if you were, if they were found, which were pretty horrible. Was there some sort of plot to oust him in the year you talk about? Something about was it Lady Arabella Stuart?
Yeah, Arbella Stuart. So she was one of the candidates that the Privy Council kind of had in mind to replace Queen Elizabeth when she died. But unfortunately, a guy called Robert Cecil made sure that wasn't going to happen because she had quite a large Catholic following. In this year, there's two plots, really. One, the main plot, and one, the by-plot. They kind of interlink, but it's kind of brought together by a group of noblemen who aren't satisfied with James being king, with his toleration of Protestantism and his advocation of Protestantism, including Sir Walter Riley, obviously, who's quite a famous guy. But not many people seem to kind of know about his involvement in this plot. So they kind of band together and come up with a plan to kidnap James and his eldest son, Prince Henry, dethrone him and replace him with Arbella and bring back Catholicism, or at the very least kind of create more of a tolerance for Catholicism.
Is there some sort of support then, sort of complicit or covert support coming out of Rome? Because obviously Henry VIII has dissolved all the monasteries and quite conveniently taken all their land and wealth as well. So, you know, were they being viewed, the conspirators, with all egged on or some helped from the Vatican, for example?
I'm not quite so sure about the Vatican, but certainly from Spain.
Right.
There was, which is obviously quite good for this interview. There was some support from, because Spain was a very, and I think continues to be, a mostly Catholic country.
Is Philip still in the throne in Spain then at this point, or is he long gone?
You're testing me now. There is one Philip that is on the throne at this point who is kind of, he's supporting the plot in a very kind of a tangential way. So he's not, you know, he's pledging money, etc. Whether he was really serious about it, I'm not sure. But there was definitely Spanish support, and I think that's where a lot of the drive for the plot came from. Because Spain was obviously, and Spain had a very complicated history with England. Obviously, the Spanish Armada of 1588. And England and Spain were still technically at war at this point. So I think any way that Spain could help to shake things up in England, they were going to kind of jump into that.
I mean, they're still smarting, aren't they, over the Armada, etc. And whatever, because there are so many Felipes at this point. But, you know, he was an absolutely austere Catholic, and he was trying to export his version of, if you like, fanatical Catholicism, which was a huge thing, wasn't it? I mean, these are the whole great power struggles across Europe at the point.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think that was probably one of the things that he had in mind with this new main by-plot, finishing what he started with the Armada, which unfortunately didn't go well for the Spanish.
One of the other things that strikes me is the power of these families. Because if you think about the royal families today, you think, oh yeah, it's very quaint, etc. These, you know, the dukes of this and the what's it of that. But at the time we're talking about, they wield enormous power, don't they? Through, and it is, if you like, a hangover from sort of Plantagenet's late medieval period.
Yeah, totally. I mean, they were kingmakers. They held arguably the greatest power in the land, and a lot of them were certainly richer than the royal family. Going back a bit, they were the ones that had standing armies, and they were in charge of those armies if the king wanted to fight a war abroad or something. And those kind of relics of their power and prestige are still littered all over the country today with these great houses that we see.
we always talk about, when we think about the this sort of period, there's always wars, you know, there's always the religious thing. And then stalking in the background and popping up every at least once a century is plague. And, you know, we only seem to think about plague as the, sort of the Black Death of the early Middle Ages, or the Middle Ages, if that's a term. But it makes a comeback again, doesn't it, during that year of his reign?
It does indeed. It hasn't been seen for about 4 years, but even then, that outbreak wasn't too serious. But it comes back with a vengeance this year. In 1603, and it was very interesting because I wrote this book just before the outbreak of COVID. It was very eerie when COVID started, and I was seeing these kind of patterns from 1603 replaying in 2020. That was very spooky because I felt like I'd already been through it. In 1603, it comes from the Netherlands, from Ostend. I think some soldiers carry it across to England, and they were supposed to quarantine themselves, and unfortunately they didn't. And plague is very, very contagious, and it spread like wildfire very quickly in London. But then, as I say in the book, it spreads out into the rest of the country and causes some devastation.
And when you, again, it's not all sort of high court stuff. You're looking at the lives of ordinary men and women. And if you get a new king who is, you know, who is from another country, and the people are going, okay, perhaps we will spend our judgment. And then you get an outbreak of plague. Many of them may think this is divine retribution for putting James on the throne.
That's a very interesting point. I've not actually seen any evidence for that, but I'm sure that some people thought exactly that. It was, you know, for a superstitious people, it would have seemed like an odd coincidence for plague to suddenly appear upon the coming of James to England. So, yeah, no, that's an interesting point. I've not seen any evidence for it, but yeah, I would take that point definitely.
How do you... Because I said before, it is from the ordinary person's perspective as well as being high court. So, how do you get the documentation? How do you do the research to give that? Because we will obviously all the courtier stuff and all the foreign relations is well documented. But for the actual, if you like, this is sort of the man trudging around London trying not to catch plague.
Yeah, you have to be quite clever with it, to be honest, and it is difficult, but there are records out there. There are things like quarter sessions records. The Court of Quarter Sessions was held four times a year, and you get ordinary people kind of surfacing in that, and sometimes they talk about plague and that, but I use that for other parts of the year as well. Assize records are pretty good, and I was able to use those to track down some ordinary folk who rallied against the king and said bad things about him, kind of even capturing exactly what they said, kind of in quotation marks, which was really interesting. Without those, I mean, that would have just been lost to history. But also parish burial registers are my friend and were my friend during the writing of this book, because they listed all the ordinary people who died of plague. And for some reason, parish clerks, they didn't tend to list causes of death for anything else. But for plague, they seemed to get a bit excited about it, and they would say that this person died from plague, which obviously is understandable because it was such a terrifying time.
And obviously, 1603... It starts it's the early part of a century that sees Chamartin. We kind of overlook the Stuarts and the Georgians and all that, but we do that at our peril because we have the Civil War some 39 years later. England, you know, has its Civil War, and then we have Cromwell and the Restoration. So this, could you argue that James I's going to becoming the King of England sets off a chain of motion that will culminate in that period in the middle of sort of 40 years later in the tumultuous civil war?
Yeah, potentially. Just to go back to your first point about kind of definitely the early 17th century is overlooked a lot. You get the Tudors of the 16th century who are studied to death, and there are all sorts of programs and dramas about them on telly. But yeah, the early 17th century, I feel, even the Civil War to a certain extent, is quite overlooked. That's kind of my mission, is to bring that bit of history to a wider audience. But in terms of whether James set off a chain reaction, he probably did, because he came up with the notion of the divine right of kings, which was basically a misguided notion that the king was answerable only to God and to nobody else. And obviously, when Charles I came to the throne, his son, he took this very literally, and as a result, really alienated his parliament, because he felt like he didn't need them to rule because he wasn't answerable to them. And I mean, there were other factors. Charles just wasn't a very good king. His administration was pretty poor, but yeah, that's what slid the country into civil war. So yeah, no, definitely, you can definitely trace it back to James.
What do you hope that people learn from James the First's tumultuous first year of king as king?
I want people to learn about the history of the year, and how important I think it is in the history of this country. It would be nice for people to kind of, I don't know, make some links with our current king, Charles III, in his first year. Obviously, he's coming after a long-reigning Elizabeth, just like James was back in 1603. So there are parallels to be drawn there. But I'd also like people to get to know some of the ordinary folk who really are lost to history, especially women. And I hate to say that it is mostly the male ordinary person that I talk about in this book, but that's just the limitation of the sources. But yeah, I'd love people to get a sense of, you know, what they themselves might have been up to in that year as well. I mean, that was the point of it.
And also, hopefully, that uses a springboard for people to dive into the Stuarts, because it's a fascinating history, and the Civil War, and, you know, and the Reformation, etc., the Restoration. It's absolutely wonderful stuff, and so it knocks the spots off the other Berlin girls, doesn't it, really?
It definitely does, yeah. I would definitely argue that.
The book is called James I's Tumultuous First Year as King, Plague, Conspiracy and Catholicism. It's by Ben Norman, who we're speaking to today. Ben, if people want to find you and find out more about the book and your other stuff, where can they find you online?
They can find me on LinkedIn. Should be able to find me easily enough. I don't have a website yet, but I'm hoping to create one. But yeah, if you... Pen and Sword is my publisher, so you can contact them if you'd like to speak to me some more.
Wonderful. And the book's also going to be available as a virtual download from our virtual bookstore. This book is called James the First, Tumultuous First Year of King. It's by Ben Norman. Ben, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.